Tax Update for July 21st, 2007. Welcome to the Tax Update for July 21st, 2007. This week, but it has to be something, the tax court penalizes a taxpayer for sloppy records. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting documents may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio recording. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.linebergservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.linebergservices.com. This week, we're going to revisit the Cohen rule we've discussed in the past and look at it from the perspective of an attempt by a large public company to apply the Cohen rule to a problem that came about when they tried to unravel a transaction and figure out what was in a particular set of accounts on the books of a subsidiary. The case in question was a case of Tyson Foods and Subsidiaries versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2007-188. Now, the tax court ends up holding that Tyson Foods would not be able to depreciate over $2 million worth of what appears to have been, or what Tyson believes was, equipment, because the entity was unable to identify what made up those amounts. The tax court rejected the argument that it should apply the Cohen decision to give Tyson at least a depreciation deduction on this $2 million of expenditures they couldn't identify, on the theory that, well, in the worst case for Tyson, that's what it had to be, was depreciable asset of some sort. Now, as noted, we've looked at Cohen previously in podcasts, but it's kind of useful to review it every so often and go back over the Cohen issue. It's probably a very useful review now that we have the changes to Section 6694 in our standards of care and some of our concerns about how we interpret and how we apply the various provisions here, because Cohen is one of those that's always available when the records are unavailable, and we have to consider at what point does Cohen apply and will Cohen apply to our taxpayer. Now, the general requirement is taxpayers are required to maintain records. Section 6001 has the general requirement that every person liable for tax imposed by this title or collection shall keep records and render such statements, make such returns, and comply with the rules and regulations as the Secretary may from time to time prescribe. On Regulation 1.6001-1A, we find the general rule for record keeping, and that rule says that except as provided in paragraph B, and paragraph B deals with a limited exception, or basically a more limited standard for farmers and wage earners, any person subject to tax under subtitle A of the code, which means the income tax, or any person required to file a return of information with respect to income shall keep such permanent books of accounts or records, including inventories, as are sufficient to establish the amount of gross income, deductions, credits, or other matters required to be shown by such person in any return of such tax or information. So under Section 6001, we basically have a requirement to keep records to support the tax returns that we're putting forward. And even under the limited exception we find for wage earners and farmers, there's still basically a record requirement. Now, the Cohen case was the question of what happens if a taxpayer violates this, or at least doesn't have the records. And in the case of Cohen, which is a 1930 case involving George M. Cohen, the vaudeville entertainer, the Board of Tax Appeals initially disallowed Mr. Cohen's deductions in their entirety because of the lack of records. However, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the ruling and gave us what became the Cohen Doctrine. Now, in the case, in the relevant part of the case, we're discussing what becomes the Cohen Doctrine. The Court of Appeals noted that in the production of his plays, Cohen was obligated to be free-handed entertaining actors, employees, and, as he naively adds, dramatic critics. He also had to travel much, and at times with his attorney. These expenses amounted to substantial sums, but he kept no account and probably could not have done so. Now, note, these are the type of expenses that today would not be eligible for a Cohen exception, but in the days of George Cohen, when he filed this case, there was no special rules under 274 for such expenses. So we go on. At trial before the board, he estimated he had spent $11,000 in this fashion during the first 6 months of 1921. Remember, in 1921, $11,000 would have been quite a substantial sum. $22,000 between July 1st, 1921 and June 30th, 1922, and as much for his following fiscal year, $55,000 in all. The board, which was the predecessor to the tax court, refused to allow him any part of this on the ground it was impossible to tell how much he in fact spent in the absence of any items or details. The question is how far this refusal is justified in view of the finding that he has spent much and that sums were allowable expenses. Absolute certainty in such matters is usually impossible and is not necessary. The board should make as close an approximation as it can, bearing heavily, if it chooses, upon the taxpayer whose inexactitude is of his own making. But to allow nothing at all appears to us inconsistent with saying that something was spent. True, we do not know how many trips Cohen made, nor how large his entertainments were, yet there were obviously some basis for computation necessary by drawing upon the board's personal estimates of the minimum of such expenses. The amount may be trivial and unsatisfactory, but there was basis for some allowance, and it was wrong to refuse any, even though it were traveling expenses of a single trip. It is not fatal that the result will inevitably be speculative. Many important decisions must be such. We think that the board was in error as to this and must reconsider the evidence. Now, as noted, Congress has gone back and in certain cases has imposed specific requirements for documentation that override the Cohen decision. 274 is one example. We saw recent changes made to the charitable contribution rules. There are a number of provisions in charitable contributions where if you don't have the proper documentation, you will not get the deduction. But if Congress has not overridden Cohen, it's still good law on the court in the books today, and we still see cases decided that reference Cohen. In fact, that was what Tyson Foods was going for in the particular case we're going to talk about here today, because they had some problems in the accounting for certain transactions. Now, this particular case involved initially a frozen food manufacturer that was not owned by Tyson, Culinary Foods, Inc. After they suffered a fire in their facilities, the entity eventually looked to rebuild a new facility, and the city of Chicago offered to pay a $5 million subsidy effectively if the firm would build its new facility in a certain section of the city they wanted it built in. Culinary Foods took the city up on this offer and signed up to construct its facility in that location. 2 months after this agreement, Tyson Foods purchased the stock of Culinary Foods in a transaction that was treated for federal income tax purposes as a purchase of asset. Now, Tyson allocated the purchase price among various assets, but allocated nothing to the $5 million subsidy receivable. When the funds were received from the city of Chicago, the accounting staff charged the payments against various expense accounts or asset accounts on the books of Culinary Foods, including one labeled TIF moving expenses, and ended up with a zero balance for the year in question. Now, under examination, Tyson agreed that it was inappropriate not to have allocated a portion of the purchase price to the $5 million note receivable from the city. And in fact, $5 million of the purchase price should have been allocated that way rather than allocated to other assets of the company. So Tyson went back and redid that, changed their allocation, and obviously that had an effect of reducing the values of certain other assets and items acquired in the acquisition and setting up this $5 million receivable. Now, what that meant is when the payments were received now, instead of going against the expense accounts or the asset accounts they'd been charged against, these expenses should have gone against this receivable, which means once that adjusting entry is made, if you're thinking as an accountant, you're going to realize that there's now going to be some expenses and some assets that are going to pop up on the books that weren't there before. Because now we're going to find items that when those credits go off, rather than going against those items, now go against this receivable, we're suddenly going to make some changes. Our question becomes how to handle these changes. Now, if you look in the materials, there's a list of items that were impacted by these $5 million receipts. In fact, every time a check came in, there is a journal entry that recorded the accounts against which these were charged. Now, significantly, three of the payments that were made in March, July, and November of 1995 were charged against an account called TIF moving expenses. Now, TIF moving expenses, miraculously at the end of 95, or maybe not so miraculously, showed a zero balance, so it wiped out totally at the end of the year and didn't enter into in the initial computation for culinary food subsidiary in any way the computation of taxable income because there was no deduction. Now, once these amounts were pulled out, we had a little problem of now deciding, since there would be a balance in there, what was in that account. And the IRS and Tyson agreed about the $5 million on certain amounts would be set up and be deductible as expenses. They also agreed certain amounts, specifically allocable to land and the like, would not be deductible. But there was a major disagreement on $2,007,640 of expenses. Tyson claimed that these amounts must, at the very worst, be depreciable assets recoverable over 5 years. The IRS said nothing of the sort is obvious to them. All they know is that Tyson had inadequate evidence of what these expenses represented, if anything, and no deduction of any sort, either current or recovery of depreciation, should be allowed for these payments, for these amounts on their, these kind of miscellaneous debits that were left on their trial balance. Now, Tyson's position was summarized by the tax court from the Tyson's filings, and Tyson said that their records are insufficient to determine the extent to which these expenses should have resulted in a reduction of otherwise allowable ordinary and necessary business expenses as contrasted with reduction of otherwise allowable depreciation. However, at a minimum, under the well-established Cohen rule, the petitioner is entitled to treat the entire $2,007,640 as a capital expenditure depreciable over a 5-year time period and to reduce its taxable income accordingly for the resulting additional depreciation deductions. At least, that's how Tyson's counsel viewed the matter. Now, it's important to note that Tyson's conceding, as we'll discover, that there are some real issues with the accounting underlying this particular computation. But Tyson argues that regardless of the fact that we can't really tie everything down perfectly, these must have been, under the worst case, depreciable assets. In essence, there are these debits that have now reappeared. We aren't offsetting the payments against them. And these payments must have represented, at the very worst, depreciable assets if they didn't represent currently deductible items. And IRS will be nice. Given that we don't know what they are, we think the best approach is that we go ahead and just treat them as depreciable assets. We'll recover them over 5 years. The IRS didn't agree. The IRS argued that the petitioner cavalierly relies on Cohen versus Commissioner to assert the remaining expenses are deductible, and thus the court should allow a greater deduction than the $1,800,354 already permitted by the respondent. The petitioner bases this belief on the fact that account 101226, of which petitioner alleges the remaining $2,324,193 is credited, is labeled TIF moving expenses, and because the TIF subsidy was given in accordance with culinary, then all of the $2,324,193, parenthetical note, now reduced to a $2,007,640, in dispute must represent moving expenses of food processing equipment for which the petitioner is entitled to capitalize the cost over a 5-year time period. Petitioner has no evidence to substantiate this allegation. The IRS goes on to note that the IRS is specifically complaining that the list of vendors contains no information regarding the nature of the expenses or when within calendar year 1995 the expense was incurred. The court goes on to note the IRS claims that Tyson Foods wants this court to make a leap of faith without any corroborating evidence that the remaining amounts and issues were for the purchase, installation, or moving of equipment for use in culinary's processing facility. So now we have to turn to the nature of the records that were before the tax court and what decision the tax court made. The tax court note here is evidence that certain payments were made and recorded. From that, petitioner asks us to conclude that the payments must have been either for depreciable expenses, for deductible expenses, I should say, or depreciable assets, and that the expenditures were made are attributable to a tax year before the court. The nature of that evidence obviously is going to be key in deciding this case. How good is it, and is it good enough to allow the court to make a Cohen allocation? In court, Tyson relied upon a listing and the testimony of an attorney. There was a listing of various items that these journal entries were supposed to represent that had some vague descriptions of that, of what they were. There were no invoices to go with them or any other detail, but they did have a list of the vendors who were supposedly impacted by particular transactions, and they had the testimony of an attorney who was involved with the acquisition and combining the two, Tyson believed they had established essentially what had happened. Now, in the opinion, the court summarized the evidence. It said the only evidence petitioner produced in this regard was a list of vendors and amounts that were recorded in the moving expense account and the testimony of David L. Van Beber, a lawyer involved in the culinary acquisition who had reviewed the document and concluded that this lists out certain third-party vendors that I believe culinary was utilizing or making payments to for goods or services. Van Beber was familiar with some, but not all, of the vendors on the list. As to one, for example, he testified it could be line equipment, it could be freezing equipment, it could be any number of different types of equipment that we utilize in the food processing business. Although he identified the nature of business of certain vendors, the most he could say was, and here's a question and answer from the actual trial, this is a question from petitioner's counsel, from the counsel for Tyson, do you have any views as to the nature of the invoices? And Mr. Van Beber answered, yes, I believe these invoices were for either the purchase, installation, moving equipment for the processing facility, the new processing facility on Ashland Avenue. The court notes that no invoices were in the record ever produced. And on cross-examination, Van Beber admitted that he was not involved in the accounting with respect to the TIF subsidy or the disputed expenses. Now, at the end of the day, the court was not terribly impressed with this demonstration and noted as much. It notes that Tyson repeatedly referred the list of vendors as a contemporaneous record, but the list is, in effect, contemporaneous only with respect to the recording of the amounts that went into account 10226. In essence, we know journal entries were made against that account on those dates. It is not contemporaneous, the court goes on to note, in the sense that invoices, purchase orders, or journal entries explanations reflect the nature of items purchased. The witness's speculation, based on familiarity with the nature of the vendors, is not reliable evidence that the items paid for are deductible currently or over time through depreciation. There was the problem. While Tyson could give us a list of vendors they claim were impacted by these journal entries, there was actually no basic support given behind the journal entries. And the court was not willing to take the attorney's testimony that he had kind of a vague idea of what these vendors did and the kind of things they worked for to support the assumption that therefore these particular journal entries must have been for payments to these vendors for the various types of services he was saying they generally handled. As the court noted, on a record in which it is established that erroneous accounting entries were made, and in that case, I believe the court is concerned with the fact that Tyson never did allocate the $5 million to begin with and then was running this number against expenses, we have no confidence that the expenditures are for the purpose claimed by a petitioner. Thus, we conclude the petitioner has failed to satisfy its burden of proving that it is entitled to the disputed deduction. The tax court disallowed the entirety of the $2 million in dispute and basically gives Tyson no credit whatsoever for the payments on those amounts. Now, the question becomes, why did the tax court arrive at this result? And I think it becomes fairly clear when you think about it. A key concept that impacts us in the Cohen cases is that, again, while we have the issue that the taxpayer does have the right, if it's obvious expenses were incurred and it's obvious, you know, that something happened, we can, and the court can, basically estimate the amounts involved. But to do so, it first considers the level, essentially, of culpability of the taxpayer. Do we lack the necessary information because the taxpayer didn't provide us with, or the taxpayer was responsible for the fact that this is not here? For instance, the tax court will be much more understanding to somebody who is claiming the Cohen rule with regard to records that were lost to Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans than they are going to be in this particular case where there doesn't appear to be any good explanation for why the records don't exist, except just they don't seem to exist to back this up. Nobody can unravel the transactions in question. The tax court notes, and the IRS noted too, that basically the IRS was emphasizing that petitioner has status in the industry. This is a large poultry producer. And its employment of in-house and outside accountants and tax preparers who, according to the IRS, were well aware of the record-keeping requirements of the Internal Revenue Code. In essence, the implication was they were sloppy, they knew what they should be doing, and they failed to do it. And because of that, we have to evaluate very strongly against them. any implications or estimates that would be made of expenses that were given out. As well, another tenet of the Cohen decision that's always been true is the tax court is very insistent that there must be some basis under which to basically know there were expenditures incurred and amounts incurred that should have been deductible or somehow otherwise should have been dealt with on the books and weren't. The tax court felt in this case, because of the high level of uncertainty and the fact that we had here for a fairly large public company, just the total inability to explain what was in these accounts, at least apparently, as we read what the tax court tells us about the case, that the tax court felt that that simply didn't form enough of a basis for the tax court to make any sort of estimate of the amounts that would be allowable as depreciation. They were not willing to say, well, in the worst case, it must have been depreciable. Now, this may be tough for some of us as accountants to believe because, of course, if we look at something and we know what came out of the company in terms of payments for dividends and we know the balance sheet accounts are in line, we know those expenditures were made, we're fairly certain of that, we believe that, yes, well, obviously, they were either expenses or depreciable and, therefore, something should be allowed. But we probably would also be troubled by the fact that nobody seems to be able to unravel these transactions. Now, true, probably to a certain extent, that's simply because of the sheer volume of transactions in a large entity. But we have to remember that a large entity has a lot more accounting expertise on hand in general than does a smaller entity. It's also important to note that the tax court does seem to consider that in this case. And if you have a smaller client, remember that it's not going to necessarily be held as heavily against you if the client's records are just bad because it turns out the client simply didn't have the competency to provide the records and keep them straight. Now, again, it always looks bad when either it appears nobody cared to keep good records or the records were just intentionally kept sloppy. In this case, we're not sure why those records weren't there, but the tax court, because of the type of company involved, because of accounting personnel on hand, had a tough time believing that people had exercised the due level of care to support these deductions. Your client, as long as he doesn't basically have a bad smell case, may find the court much more willing to discuss this issue. However, as always, Cohen is always kind of an iffy situation. It is very fact dependent to make a Cohen situation stick. If you have to go Cohen, you do so generally as a last resort. And you would much prefer to find a way in the future to make sure the client does not have to resort. If you have to keep resorting to Cohen, that probably by itself is a good indication of bad faith, that you're not trying to keep the records in question. So be very careful as well. Now that we're still back and stuck with evaluating, do we have a more likely than not position? The applicability of Cohen to your taxpayer situation is one of those tax positions that appear we have to worry about. Do we have a more likely than not basis for the application given the facts as applied to our client? Studying this case may help you make those decisions as we go forward trying to apply Section 6694. Now, this has been the tax update for July 21st. Again, I'm going to be presenting next week, next Friday, in fact, or this coming Friday, I should say, for the Arizona Society of CPAs and the Tax Practice and Ethics course that'll be going on. So that'll be taking an event here shortly. I'm also going to be on Tuesday giving a brief presentation on employee benefit issues at the Arizona Forum for Improvement of Taxation Conference down at the ASU downtown facility. And the week following all of that, I will be heading to Rye, New York, currently scheduled to do two courses in Rye, New York on the 2nd and 3rd of August. So I'll be out in that regard. Then following that, later in August, I do courses in Casper, Wyoming on employee benefit plans and a tax update for financial executives. And finally, then in September, I go to Ohio and do a set of courses in Ohio that'll be coming up on the CP calendar. So if you're out there and you're going to be attending one of those courses, I look forward to seeing you. The Tax Update, as always, is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to visit them there to look at their information that's of interest to tax practitioners and consider subscribing to their services. This has been the Tax Update.